This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innalladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. Innalladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillahi ulaika yarjuna rahmatallah ulaika yarjuna rahmatallahi wallahu ghafurur rahim. يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A reminder of our top stories, Hezbollah confirms that its top commander has been martyred in Israel's airstrike on Beirut, vowing to continue its efforts to thwart U.S.-Israeli blocs. Iran strongly condemns Israel's assassination of a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut, slamming the inaction of the UN on the regime's acts of terrorism. And Hamas reiterates its commitment to implementing the second phase of the Gaza truce, warning that Israel's ongoing violations threaten the core of the agreement. Live from Tehran, I am Bahman Nouri, and this is News. The Hezbollah resistance movement has confirmed the martyrdom of its senior commander Haitham Ali Tabatabai during a Sunday Israeli airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. In its statement, the movement said Tabatabai was martyred in Israel's treacherous strike on the Haaret Harek district in Beirut's southern suburbs. It described him as a committed commander whose sacrifice inspired the resistance with hope, resolve and strength in its battle against the enemy. Hezbollah stressed that following his martyrdom, resistance fighters will move forward with steadfastness and courage to defeat all projects of the Zionist enemy and its main supporter, the U.S. Israel's attack on Beirut killed at least 5 people and wounded 20 others. The strike marks another flagrant violation of the ceasefire agreement signed between the regime and Lebanon a year ago. Israel has carried out near daily attacks on southern Lebanon since then. However, this is the first time in months that Beirut has come under attack.
Israel has struck a residential building in the heart of the Beirut suburbs. The third and fourth floors of a 9-story building were badly damaged, with debris filling the road, damaging cars and property. Deputy head of Hezbollah Political Bureau confirmed that a senior commander was targeted in the strike.
This is an attempted assassination, targeting a key leader within the resistance. What matters now is that we document this as a clear act of aggression, an escalation we cannot and will not tolerate. It is our responsibility at the national level to establish a response that confronts Israel's attempt to undermine our sovereignty.
Although the Israeli statement said the target was a commander in the resistance, people near the scene say Israeli strikes are targeting everyone.
I am from this neighborhood. Every time they come up with this claim that they are targeting a member of the resistance, we are all members of the resistance. I want to tell our prime minister, who was a judge in the international court, if your diplomacy can't protect us and solve our crisis, then leave us to be and don't speak in our name. And this mechanism is obviously biased towards Israel.
Alice believes the Israeli claims that Hezbollah has rehabilitated is merely preparing the ground for a larger escalation and a U.S. green light for this aggression.
This marks a new level of violation, and there are two potential outcomes. Either the resistance retaliates, which would escalate into a full-scale war, or they absorb this blow, which could embolden Israel to carry out further strikes. Both options are devastating. This is a turning point. With Israel seeking to normalize its escalation in Lebanon, backed by U.S. support, and with the Lebanese government failing to take action.
President Joseph Aoun called on the international community to intervene firmly to stop Israeli attacks on the country. Lebanon, he said, reiterates its call to the international community to assume its responsibility and intervene firmly and seriously to stop the attacks on Lebanon and its people. The Israeli strike on the southern suburbs of Beirut and the U.S. blessing are considered part of the growing pressure by both sides to enforce full surrender by Hezbollah and full compliance of the Lebanese government to disarm the resistance. However, many believe that this opens the way for different scenarios, especially if the resistance decides it is time to retaliate. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Israel's assassination of a top Hezbollah commander in Lebanon has sparked a strong wave of condemnations from regional countries and resistance movements. Iran's foreign ministry strongly condemned Israel's, quote, cowardly assassination of Haitham Ali Tabatabai in an attack on a residential area of Beirut. The ministry said the strike was a savage assault on Lebanon's sovereignty and national integrity and a blatant violation of the country's ceasefire deal with Israel. It also slammed the inaction of the UN and Security Council on Israel's frequent crimes against Lebanon, urging immediate international action to stop the regime's terrorism. Earlier, Deputy Head of Hezbollah's Political Council, Mahmoud Kamati, said the assassination will escalate violence across Lebanon. Lebanon's President Joseph Aoun called the strike a clear sign of Israel's disregard for repeated international appeals to halt its assault. Hamas condemned the attack as a cowardly act of aggression aimed at dragging the region into a wider war, while Yemen's Ansar Allah movement denounced the strike as a blatant violation of international humanitarian law. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad also slammed the attack as a war crime. Political analyst Firas Al-Najm joined us earlier to discuss the reactions shown to the latest Israeli crime in Lebanon in more detail.
If you look at the statements from the people on the ground, just the normal civilians on the ground, and you can see that most of the people are in support of the resistance, and they are standing firmly with the resistance, and they're saying that nothing will install fear in the nation of Lebanon, especially with such great leadership such as Haytham al-Tabtaba'i or Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah or Sayyid Hashim Safi al-Din or all the great martyrs like Imad Mughniyeh, and the list goes on of all these great sacrifices that are all towards supporting the oppressed people of Palestine. And this is an honorable history, an honorable stand that will always be recorded in support of the people that need the most assistance, and that is the Palestinian people. And we've seen in these last years suffering and the suffocation of the Palestinian people and the disregard to human life. And this only makes the people more firm in their battle against this enemy, and how this enemy has no borderlines and has no true rules, and no respect for international law or any human rights groups or any human rights organizations or the United Nations whatsoever. And even the ceasefire that was brokered between Lebanon and the Zionist entity through a mediator, and that is the U.S., obviously the main culprit and the main supporter of all these crimes in this Zionist entity, they're not respecting that ceasefire agreement at all.
Gaza government media office strongly condemns Israeli violations of the U.S.-brokered Gaza ceasefire, reporting nearly 500 breaches in just 44 days. The office said these violations constitute a flagrant breach of international humanitarian law and the humanitarian protocol attached to the agreement. It stated that since the ceasefire came into effect, over 340 Palestinians have been killed in the regime's attacks, with children, women and the elderly making up the majority of the victims. The office also reported that among those violations, more than two dozen occurred on Saturday, resulting in over 20 Palestinian death and nearly 90 wounded. Meanwhile, hospitals in Gaza are running out of essential supplies, with stacks of gauze, antiseptics, thermometers and antibiotics running low due to Israel's intensified attacks. The director of nursing at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis said there is little difference from the period before the ceasefire. Mohammed Sakhar warned that there are daily crises and staff remain exhausted as they continue to receive many casualties. Our Gaza correspondent Muti Abu Musabah joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israel's repeated ceasefire violations across the war-torn territory. Let us take a listen.
A short while ago, the Israeli occupation forces renewed their artillery strikes against the eastern part of Al-Burej refugee camp, coupled with the intense mass shooting and gunfire towards those areas. And in addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces also continue to detonate more residential buildings in the eastern side of Khan Yunis city. And as you know, the current situation is still intense. And as you know, those attacks are still intense in the eastern side of Gaza city as well, which is still witnessing more full attacks by the Israeli artillery. In addition to that, the Israeli forces also proceeded to detonate further residential buildings in that area. So we are still witnessing this surge and uptick of those brutal attacks against the Palestinian people, and those attacks are still inflicting more death and destruction in those areas, and the Palestinian people are still devastated by the continuous and the ongoing violations of the ceasefire agreement. And definitely what we are witnessing on the ground is that the Israeli regime is still trying desperately to impose new realities and facts on the ground by, as you know, wiping out more residential squares, by destroying more farmlands, and, as you know, keeping Palestinian people near those areas under the heavy bombings and the ongoing attacks. So this is very precarious for the Palestinian people, as they are still living the same sentiment of the genocidal war. And this is why the Palestinian people are still vitrified.
The Hamas resistance movement says it has warned Gaza ceasefire mediators that Israel's ongoing violations of the truce deal can jeopardize its implementation. Hamas spokesperson Hazem Qassem said Israeli forces continue to shift the yellow line on a daily basis as part of their gradual encroachment strategy. He warned that such actions undermine the core of the agreement and heighten tensions on the ground. Regarding the deployment of international forces to Gaza, Qassem said the mission must include separating Palestinian civilians from the Israeli army, which presses ahead with its daily attacks. He said the implementation of the second phase of the truce would be a complex process, as Hamas has met all its obligations, but Israel continues the violations. Qassem said the presence of a Hamas delegation in Cairo reflects the movement's serious commitment to implementing the second phase of the truce. A Hamas delegation arrived in Cairo on Sunday to discuss the latest developments related to the ceasefire deal and review the outlines of its second phase with mediators. On the anniversary of the martyrdom of Lady Fatima Zahra, a funeral procession has been held in Tehran to honor 100 anonymous martyrs from the 1980s Iran-Iraq War.
ما ملت فریادیم، فریاد میزنیم مرگ بر آمریکا.
This morning's ceremony began with the presence of senior military and government officials, families of the martyrs, and ordinary people. The procession honors the sacrifices made during the 8-year sacred defense as participants accompany the martyrs to their final resting place. At the same time, across 31 provinces nationwide, the remains of 300 other anonymous martyrs are being laid to rest, marking a day of remembrance and unity for the nation. For more on this, I'm now joined by Fazan Ashuri, an ARC correspondent right now in Tehran, where the ceremony is being is taking place. Fazan, what can you tell us?
Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, where a massive crowd of Iranians have gathered here to participate in the funeral procession that is being held here in the capital, Tehran, for the unknown martyrs of the 8-year Iraqi imposed war on Iran. Well, a massive crowd of Iranians on the day of the anniversary of the martyrdom of Hazrat Zahra, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which on the Iranian calendar has been marked as the national day of honoring unknown martyrs. And here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, 100 unknown martyrs, actually their remains, are here on the road with people following the remains of the martyrs, actually they are going to be laid in rest here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. And of course, across the country, some 200 other unknown martyrs are also being actually followed by the massive crowd of the Iranians. And as you can see here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, while holding the flag of the Islamic Republic of Iran, holding the flag of the martyrs, holding the flag of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and of course, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, people from all walks of life, from different generations, young and old, with their families, are here as they believe that these martyrs have walked down the path of Hazrat Zahra, the path of sacrifice, the path of resilience, and the path of resistance.
Much Fazan, and for the update, of course, in our next connections, we also hear more from you. Fazan Ashuri joining us from Tehran. The Israeli forces and settlers press ahead with violent raids on Palestinian towns and villages across the occupied West Bank, causing more casualties. and property damage. In one of the latest incidents, a young Palestinian man was killed during a raid on the village of Deir Jarir, east of Ramallah. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 20-year-old Bara Khairi Ali Mali was shot by Israeli soldiers live fire in the chest. Local sources reported that settlers stormed the village and assaulted residents and their homes while Israeli forces provided protection for them. Since the start of the Gaza genocide, the Israeli forces and settlers have intensified their attacks across the West Bank, including the occupied city of Al-Quds. According to Palestinian sources, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed and over 10,000 others injured in the West Bank since October 2023. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators gathered outside a local synagogue in London to protest an event hosted by the World Zionist Organization. The event, titled Aliyah Day, was held to encourage Jewish immigration and settlement in the occupied Palestinian territories. A significant police presence was deployed to secure the area. Tensions rose as officers clashed with demonstrators, including a number of Jewish anti-Zionist protesters. We now listen to some of the voices from outside the synagogue.
We couldn't be more peaceful than we were today. We weren't even chanting. This is a protest organized by Jewish people. We were singing across the road, and we started being abused by the people on the other side, the Zionists. Suddenly the police comes, and as soon as we arrived, the police told us that there was Section 14 in place already.
We don't want to be protesting outside synagogues as Jews. That feels deeply wrong and uncomfortable, but we're also not going to stand by whilst our communities and our community spaces and our religious spaces and our leadership enable genocide, enable colonial occupation, encourage those in our communities, people that we grew up with, to participate in the colonial project that is Israel. So we've come together as Jewish Anti-Zionist Action and other Jewish groups in the Jewish bloc here in London, in collaboration with our friends from PowerPulse, to protest this event.
We are protesting against this, the Zionist people who sell the places in Israel for the settlers. It's against the Jewish religion to have our own state in exile. It's forbidden by God to steal land from other people.
And that is a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you so much for staying with us. It's goodbye from me, Bahman Roy.
Silence, a man was burning and keeping the light alive. A bone in his throat, a thorn in his eye. In silence, a man was burning. Keeping the light alive. To tell his secrets to our and bury his pains in the desert. A man who knew the ways in the heavens better than the ways on earth. Love.
ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murarisi here with another special edition of this program, The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition and during this sacred and holy month of Ramadan, we'll try to talk about some parts of Iftitah supplication, and we'll be bringing you the commentary on some parts of this supplication. We'll be back again after you listen to some parts of this dua, so stay with us.
Alhamdulillah, الذي لا يهتك حجابه ولا يغلق بابه ولا يرد سائله ولا يخيب آمنه.
Praise be to Allah. No one can disclose anything hidden by him, and no one can shut the doors kept open by him, and no one who makes a request is sent away disappointed by him. In the previous programs, we concluded that the doors of God's mercy are ever open, and having this kind of God, it is impolite to worship our God sluggishly and despondently, or even think that he is indebted to us because of our worship. So we must see who our master is at first, and we must know him, and then we try to acquire more knowledge about him. Because he himself has said that he admits everybody without any discrimination. As Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has said, لا يشغله شأن عن شأن. No action hinders him from engaging in another. So if we reflect, we realize that our prayers and supplications are nothing but commissions of sin. For example, let us assume that after a long time of separation and being away from our friend, then we meet him and then we are supposed to have an hour of discussion, sacred discussion. But during our meeting, we turn our back and we're busy with other work, maybe fiddling with everything else and other things. Such a behavior is obviously offensive. If we are supposed to meet a prominent figure and we do the same, it is more offensive and unpleasant, of course, since it proves we have been indifferent in all these times. But our lack of attention to God or presence of heart during prayer is most offensive and shameful. If after God has given us the opportunity to be in his presence and talk to him, we do not pay attention to him, we deserve severe punishment, which is worthy even if it kills us. I mean, he is the God. We have been away from him. We had turned away from him. And now we have come back and we do not have the presence of heart. In spite of all these things, God does not reject us. In fact, he always invites us to partake in his banquet. And also, on the other hand, God's forgiveness and compassion should not make us arrogant. Commensurate to our knowledge, we are bound to discharge our duty in the best possible manner. I mean, there are some prayers and supplications which are mere recitation of some words without that spirit of worship, without intention, without the presence of heart which is needed in worship. Those kinds of prayers and supplications are devoid of grace. We must struggle to make our prayers, supplications, and other devotional acts acquire the spirit of worship, which of course means at first we should try to understand their meaning, and then we can try to have the presence of heart.
الذي أنزل فيه The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it, and whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which he has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
And let me tell you one, there is something else which is equally wrong, and that is to delay the performance of acts of worship, especially the obligatory ritual prayers, which is of course equally wrong to this that we mentioned. We should not imagine that if the saying of prayer is somehow delayed, we will become more enthusiastic in performing it. In many cases, the delay itself is a kind of satanic insinuation, that waswasa that is under the guise of tiredness, sometimes under the guise of work and the like. Prayer which is performed after its prescribed time, we must admit, is deficient and spiritless. And of course we should note that no matter how the level of our acts of worship be, they should not be abandoned. Instead, we must strive to perform them better and be more polite and humble in the presence of God. To abandon them is a sin itself and is a sign of ingratitude. The solution is not to abandon a devotional act, but to improve it. Unfortunately, there are some narrow-minded people who think that prayer or supplication which is devoid of understanding is useless. This is not true. Besides the outer expressions of worship, we must beseech God to give us presence of heart and the opportunity to increase our understanding and love of Him. And this is, in fact, another grace and favor of the Almighty Allah, and we should be aware of that. And if we grow that sense of understanding, that sense of knowledge and gnosis, we will see that there will be the result of love and affection as a product of this ma'rifah, inshallah. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program as well. We ask the Almighty Allah to bestow on us the power and bravery to face dreadful events in our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding IRIB English Radio.
related to the group of seven is always controversial. At the annual meetings of the seven industrial nations, important issues are discussed. Topics such as political decisions, economic problems, and climate challenges. These countries, which control 60% of the world's economy, seek solutions to crises that threaten not only their own populations, but the lives of all inhabitants of the planet. For this reason, the G7 summit carries great significance for news agencies and scientific circles. Months in advance, experts and journalists propose subjects to draw the attention of policymakers. The events of 2013 were of this same nature, a year in which the G7 summit differed markedly from previous years. Given the circumstances of that time, it would not have been surprising if experts had recommended focusing on climate change, the economic crisis following 2008, or the Syrian war and the rise of Daesh, but that was not the case. For example, one British expert took a different stance. Professor Sally Davis, the UK government's health advisor, released a striking report. A report she considered more important than terrorism or climate change. The subject of her report was antibiotic-resistant bacteria. In a stark warning, Davis declared, "Bacterial resistance to antibiotics is like a ticking time bomb."
I'm a hematologist, but I became chief medical officer in England and senior medical advisor to the UK government in 2010. And early on in my time, I realized that antimicrobial resistance, manifested by drug-resistant infections, was out of hand. And not only was it soaring nationally in the UK and abroad, but we'd got an empty pipeline, so not enough, hardly any new drugs coming through. And there really wasn't much of a focus on it. And I thought that we needed to campaign to try and get people to understand the severity of the problem and then take some action.
She emphasized that in the coming years, even a simple surgery could end in human death. Infections might, as in past centuries, claim the lives of millions and bring all medical treatments to a halt. Davis's remarks were unexpected and shocking. She said this crisis threatens not only her own country, England, but humanity as a whole, a crisis that could become the defining danger of the future world.
Drug-resistant infections are now killing a lot of people. At least 7,000 people worldwide, and that's going to go up to 10 million a year by 2050 if we don't take action. Moreover, as it goes up, more than 28 million people will be driven into abject poverty. So this is a serious issue.
The audience for Davis's warnings were the leaders of the seven industrial nations, countries that could, at the upcoming summit, address this hidden crisis. Yet her remarks contained another startling point. She stressed that over the years, bacteria had grown resistant to antibiotics, but there was also a new problem. Davis's report revealed that since 1987, no new antibiotic had been developed. 25 decisive years in which bacteria, by strengthening their defenses, managed to push the planet to the brink of crisis. This crisis raised new questions for world leaders and ordinary people alike. Were Davis's words true? What was behind the halt in antibiotic production? And who could possibly prevent this looming catastrophe? The answers to these urgent questions lay not in the headlines, but in the history of antibiotics, a history full of strange events.
Centers for Disease Control warning hospitals nationwide about a growing number of superbugs.
There's a new deadly superbug spreading in hospitals across America.
Half of all the patients who get it die.
The nightmare bacteria are now completely untreatable.
When British media covered Davis's proposal to the G7, another event took place in London. In the archives of the British Library, a handwritten manuscript from the 10th century had caught the attention of experts. The book Bald's Leech Book contained a strange medical recipe, a traditional remedy for fighting infections. Experts considered this medieval text a kind of antibiotic, contrary to the claims of critics who restricted antibiotics to only the modern era. This book, along with other historical evidence, showed that the struggle against infections was an ancient aspiration as old as human history itself. The first attempts to combat infections began with the peoples of ancient Egypt and Greece. These civilizations had discovered through experience that molds and certain plants could help destroy infections. Their methods continued to be used in later centuries, and in fact, the writing of that medieval manuscript was influenced by these practices. The methods kept only a small number of patients alive. Regardless of the outcome, the fight against infections persisted after the Middle Ages and into the 20th century, a century that brought medicine into a new phase. During World War I, the greatest concern of doctors was reducing the casualties among soldiers. They tried every possible way to save more lives, but with little success. Bacteria quickly infected soldiers' wounds, and those wounds became the main cause of death. Doctors such as Alexander Fleming, the Scottish physician, sought a solution to this problem in the years after the war. For a decade, his experiments yielded no results, until in September 1928, something unexpected happened. He accidentally discovered that the fungus Penicillium had antibacterial properties. This discovery, soon known as penicillin, was considered the first of the antibiotics, a substance capable of destroying harmful bacteria in animals. But after this discovery, an important question arose among Fleming's colleagues. Could this drug also work in the human body? Over the next two decades, the answer to Fleming's crucial question was found. Extensive research on his results led to the development of antibiotics. These substances, originally natural in origin, were now being produced in laboratories to save the lives of both animals and humans. The creation of drugs such as neomycin, kanamycin, and nystatin was the outcome of these efforts that further increased the fame of antibiotics. Yet, a serious problem remained. Antibiotics could only save millions of lives if they were produced on a large scale. The greatest challenge facing medicine was the mass production of antibiotics, a challenge that coincided with an unexpected and bitter event, World War II. When Hitler spread the flames of war across Europe, countless soldiers were sent to the front. Many were transferred to field hospitals, where doctors once again relived the bitter memories of the First World War. The infected wounds of thousands of soldiers had to be treated, not only to save their lives, but because politicians needed every single one of them to secure victory in the war. The only thing that could meet this need was antibiotics, and the only entities capable of producing them in vast quantities were governments. The warring states pressured pharmaceutical companies, and the process of antibiotic production began. The process, by keeping human forces alive, was able to change the course of the war.
Allied casualties in Normandy received the most expert medical care science can provide. Two modern treatments, penicillin and blood transfusion, have cheated death in thousands of cases. Gangrene, from which millions have perished in past wars, has been conquered by the miracle of penicillin. Thousands of men, thanks to penicillin, will come home to their thankful families. The whole world of peace to come will reap the benefits of this great wartime medical discovery. Science has won another victory over death.
By the final year of World War II, antibiotics were produced only for soldiers. But after Germany's defeat, everything changed. Doctors had managed to demonstrate the importance of antibiotics to politicians who, armed with the successful experience of war, returned to rebuild the cities. What mattered most in this reconstruction was neither money nor military power. Governments were still focused on keeping their human resources alive. A strange idea emerged for the new post-war era: capitalism. Capitalism encouraged greater production and consumption, and economists knew that to achieve this, they needed, above all, large numbers of healthy people who could both work in factories and buy the products those factories produced. In past centuries, early deaths and widespread diseases had been humanity's nightmare. Even 20th century people had endured the deadly Spanish flu. The illnesses limited global population growth. For this reason, antibiotics became capitalism's favorite drug. Within a short time, their use created a miracle in public health. Human lifespan increased, minor and major infections were no longer fatal, and most importantly, dangerous surgeries became possible. Antibiotics were the key to successful organ transplants and complex operations, saving lives in yet another way. Population growth owed itself to antibiotics, while capitalism owed its expansion to the increase in labor and consumption. The global economy quickly grew through this mechanism, and the fame of antibiotics even entered popular culture. Now every patient, regardless of education level, expects a doctor to prescribe antibiotics, so it's not surprising that, according to annual statistics, 2.5 billion people worldwide consume them, a seemingly healing drug whose use is not only widespread directly, but also hidden in certain cases. Billions may believe they do not take antibiotics, but critics argue this is a mistaken assumption. Antibiotics hold secrets that most people remain unaware of. In the mid-20th century, just before antibiotics were mass-produced for humans, another development occurred. Researchers announced that this drug could first and foremost transform food production and human food security. Until then, the production of food products was not subject to specific health regulations. And in some countries, traditional methods of production meant that bacteria entered the human body along with food. The discovery of antibiotics changed this process, and researchers proposed their use in the livestock and poultry industry. The industry for years had struggled with widespread animal deaths and diseases, problems that limited meat production and kept its price high. But antibiotics worked like a miracle. This substance could help livestock farmers in three ways. First, by preventing disease. Second, by treating sick animals. And third, and most importantly, by astonishingly accelerating the growth rate of animals. This was welcome news for the livestock industry.
The power to promote growth. Note the weight of a chicken raised for 8 weeks on a regular feed. Now another chicken nourished for the same period on regular feed plus paramycin, a 15% increase in growth.
Now it was possible to imagine mass, fast and cheap meat production and to raise meat consumption even among the poor. This was the beginning of industrial livestock farming, which started with the prescription of antibiotics. Yet, after a few years, strange events occurred. The events could not be hidden from the public eye. Animals looked cheerful only on product packaging, while the real conditions were far different from the advertising images. Soon, painful pictures from the industrial farms reached the public. The miserable conditions of reproduction were only part of the story. Exploitation, poor living environments, and finally, brutal methods of slaughter were exactly what had been foreseen. Keeping chickens in cramped, dark spaces was as disturbing as watching the treatment of sheep during shearing. The crowding of fish in oxygen-deprived pools could be as troubling as the abuse of cattle. These images were the result of one development, mass meat production made possible by antibiotics. But these images were not the only problem. Critics pointed to the livestock industry as the source of a new crisis. Statistics show that 80% of antibiotics produced in the United States are consumed by the livestock sector. In Europe, the figure is about 50%. These numbers are themselves the crisis, one that also negatively affects animals in another way. Critics argue that the excessive use of antibiotics in livestock farming has brought the world to the brink of disaster. Over the past decades, this industry, in pursuit of greater profit, has used enormous amounts of the drug, creating a situation that has now led to the emergence of microbes and bacteria resistant to antibiotics. Findings suggest that animals' bodies have become so saturated with antibiotics that they can no longer fight off new bacteria. The growth of resistant bacteria in the appalling conditions of industrial farms creates the central crisis. The widespread outbreak of bacteria among animals and their mass deaths. A looming catastrophe that, it is said, has another hidden dimension. A dangerous dimension that threatens not only animals, but humans as well.
Every day I witness calamity. Every day I witness your tragedy. When my Lord gave me my eyes, he drew on them your figure. So wherever I would see the son of Ali alone, no family crying, who will help me? But then my eyes would see the son of Ali alone, no family crying, who will help me? And I watch as by walls you are circled, and I watch as my beloved is killed. Every day it's with me a memory. Every day I witness your tragedy. Within the realm of your love I awoke and wondered, whenever I called your name, it was Zainab that answered. You call for my brother, expecting an answer. I ran between fire and he would not answer. You call for my brother, expecting an answer. I ran between fire and he would not answer. I cried out, running after his children. I cried out, wanting him to assist them. Every day I ask him to come to me. Every day I witness your tragedy. I was thirsty for your love. Your name on my heart was drawn. I asked you to quench this thirst and was met by two hands tall. Abbas came toward me,
Hussein. Oh, servant, daily you remember him. Every day, Hussein's banner I carry. Every day, I witness your tragedy. Just like a moth to a flame, I was drawn to your beauty. You became my every thought. Loving you was a duty. But when I'd remember you, I would see shimmer. I'd see a head severed, raised high upon a spear, and I weep whenever I recall you, and I weep whenever I think of you. Every day, Hussein, daily and nightly, every day, I witness your tragedy.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان